You're listening to the Plugged In podcast presented by the Institute for Energy Research. To find out more about our work, visit theinstituteforenergyresearch.org.
Welcome back to the Plugged In podcast. I'm your host, Alex Stevens. Today's episode is going to be released on Earth Day, and I can't think of one, possibly two better guests to discuss environmental issues with today than who we have lined up for you. We have Dr. Pierre Desrochers today and possibly Joanna Shermack. We're going to be discussing their co-authored book, Population Bomb, Exploding the Link Between Overpopulation and Climate Change. Pierre, welcome to the show.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having us.
This has been in the running for a little while now. I'm ashamed to say I've been the one who's been dragging my feet a bit on this since we met at a conference a little while back. But Earth Day seemed like a good opportunity to chat with you guys, and I'm excited to get into it. So I'm always interested in people who are willing to wade into somewhat controversial topics and with unique perspectives, but particularly interested in people who are able to do it in a thoughtful and rigorous way. And that's something that you two have obviously accomplished with this book. So to start, so what led you to write this and challenge sort of the commonly held belief that population and climate change are obviously linked together? And then just give our listeners a sense of your background and then the thinkers and writers who've helped you develop your perspective on these issues.
Yeah, it's a long story. I will turn 55 in a couple of weeks. So I've been working on these issues really since the early 1990s. I mean, I'm an economic geographer by training. And for people who don't know what we're supposed to be doing, it's a little bit of transportation, business location. But what was really popular in the early 1990s, when I sort of jumped into the fray, was to study places like Silicon Valley and how human creativity works and is enhanced by being located in certain places. So what I thought my contribution would be at the time was to bring some insights from cognitive psychology into the discipline. And because I always had an interest in environmental issue, I kind of discovered the work of Julian Simon at the same time. And I don't think that Simon needs much of an introduction to your audience. And what interested me in Simon was obviously not only the statistics that he brought, but the fact that before he passed away way too early, he was beginning to develop a framework that looked at human creativity, problem solving, and how, in the context of a market economy, people spontaneously come up with new solutions, or let's say less bad ways of doing things, and that in a market order, if you will, spontaneously create more resources and create lesser problems than those that existed before. And what I thought I could do at the time was to sort of supplement the work of Simon by some of the insights that I'd gained by reading a lot in the history of technology, cognitive psychology, and another line of work that I had begun at that time. You know, I became a geographer because I really don't fit well into any one academic discipline. I had sort of discovered what was then called industrial ecology, and these days is known as the circular economy, which is this notion that there shouldn't be any waste in industrial ecosystem. Now, just like in nature, the waste, if you will, of one species is used by another and nothing is wasted, industry should sort of work that way. Well, my work had led me to sort of discover this on my own before I discovered the academic community that worked on these issues. And I'd come to the conclusion, based partly of my work on Simon, my reading in the history of technologies, that markets spontaneously delivered that, that what we now call a circular economy is what a market economy is all about. And so if you let market works, if you let price signals do their things, if you let humans be creative, then you can certainly have more people, more wealth, and lesser environmental impact in the long run. And then eventually, against all odds, I actually found a decent academic job. And what was interesting was that I inherited an energy course that had been dormant for 5 years and that had been developed by a former student of a writer that some of your listeners may know, Václav Smil of the University of Manitoba. So one of his students was affiliated with my department a number of years before I joined. I started a course based on Smil's writing. And when I was hired, the guy who hired me was like, oh, you know about industrial waste recycling, you're an economic geographer, here, the energy course is yours and do what you want. And at first I thought, okay, fine, I'll just do what my predecessor did. But he was then using a book of Smil that had been out of print, which was his energy and history book. And so I ended up having to start the energy course from scratch. And long story short, from energy to climate change to population to industrial ecology, I began dabbling into that topic. And the end result of all of that, if you will, eventually was the book that I co-wrote with Joanna. Hopefully will be able to join us at some point. Population Bomb, in which I merge my interest in the history of technology, human creativity, and the fear of climate change. And how can we reconcile economic growth and a cleaner environment? Kind of hope this sort of made sense.
Yeah, you'll be happy to know. So the syllabus for your course, it's probably an older one, but it's what I give to our interns and our research assistants when they join us. So it's we're making good use of it even outside of the university. So,
well, if I may, that's one thing I insist on doing. The way I look at things, taxpayers pay for my work, and if American people are going to benefit from it. But yeah, I've never understood the academics who believe that their syllabus are proprietary and that they should be hiding them behind a university paywall. I've always insisted on making all my stuff really available, and I'm glad that you guys made some use of it.
Yeah, well, and then your background's interesting. I'm just thinking back to when I was younger in school, the predominant view of environmental topics was everything that I was kind of hit with over and over again. And thinking back, I mean, in undergrad, I took maybe an environmental geography course, and it was really the only perspective that came up. And it wasn't until I sought out other perspectives and people like Rob Bradley, who we know mutually, getting to interact with them. It wasn't until then that I discovered, no, wait, there's a whole nother view to this stuff. And then when you look back at the historical record of governments getting involved in environmental issues and things, it is much more of the story than what's commonly presented to the
But if public. I may, yeah, it's too bad that, well, I mean, obviously you're young enough to have known that generation of geographers. But what's interesting is that all the way up to, let's say, the mid-1970s, a lot of economic geographers or human geographers in general were old-fashioned Marxists. And if you know anything about the history of Marxism, they were very Promethean in their outlook. They believed that, the environmentalist movement was really a move by the bourgeoisie against the poor, and that under the guidance of, the central directorate of the Communist Party, you could actually create wealth and lift people out of poverty. And you can go back to the early 70s and you find that in a way, Julian Simon and the Marxists do share something in common, this view that the human brain and technology can actually lift people out of poverty and at the same time address pollution problems, or else the Marxists would consider that addressing poverty was more important than things that might be of greater interest to people who are already well off. And so that's actually one thing that I need to remind most audiences of today, that, Simon and the Marxists in a way came from the same Promethean tradition, but obviously Simon believed that the best way to achieve these results was through the free market, whereas old-fashioned Marxists believed that it was through an enlightened elite that would come up with central plans and deliver all of this. So, but unfortunately, even geographers have forgotten their old roots. And these days, you've got this weird dichotomy between people who believe that if you believe in human ingenuity or the way that humans can overcome poverty and create better technologies, then it automatically makes you right wing. And if you believe in degrowth, if you believe that poverty is inherently more sustainable, that immediately makes you a left wing. But this is a rather recent development. And you were asking me before, why did I write the book? Well, I wanted to remind people of that too, that if you go back all the way to the 70s, optimist people were not only the free marketers, but also old-fashioned Marxists. But that's, maybe we can explore that later.
Well, no, you're highlighting a great aspect of the book. Something I want to go through is a bit of the history of the debates over population concerns. And you sent me an email and you made a great point that, often when this debate comes up, we sort of brush through some of the main figures. We talk about Malthus, we talk about, Bob Ehrlich, Julian Simon. One of the great things about the book is the broader historical perspective that you guys bring. That a lot of the other books in the genre don't necessarily have. So can you give our listeners sort of a scope of the debate, how they played out over times, and then the shifting justifications for concerns about population?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that the perspective that you and I would subscribe, or at least in part, this belief that humans have evolved beyond other animal species, that we're not just a bigger plague of locusts. You know, humans trade, we move physical goods over long distances, we innovate by combining things in new ways. So the more we invent, the more we can invent. Yes, we might screw up along the way with new technologies, new ways of extracting resources. But if you look in the long run, we tend to make things better for both human and nature. This view really can be traced back to the Enlightenment. And if you will, the roots of both old-fashioned Marxists, but most of what you would call the left in the 19th century is really, again, well, I use this word Prometheanism. So for people who are not familiar with Prometheus, you've got to go back to ancient Greek mythology. And a short version of the story is that Prometheus is a titan. So not a god, but a very powerful being. And in some versions of the myth, he really takes pity upon human beings because we're not very fast, we're not very strong, our teeth are not very powerful. And so he takes pity upon humans and he brings them fire. And the whole point of the myth is to say that, well, how did humans end up on the top of the food chain? And the way ancient Greeks understand it, like all smart people throughout history, is that what sets us apart, again, is our brain, our capacity to invent things. So let's see, a beaver will build a dam mixing mud, logs, and rocks, but that's all they do. The closest thing to us are some types of insect, like ants and termites that build their environments and also farm mushrooms and other things, which is why you have so many ants in the world. But really what sets human apart is our capacity to develop new things and to have developed patterns of behaviors that you don't see in the rest of the animal kingdom. So fast forward to the age of the Enlightenment, and a lot of people believe, both from the left and from the right, that humans can improve their lot in life. So we're beginning to understand how nature works. We're beginning to understand the nature of matter. We can look at atoms, molecules. We can play with things. And you have two traditions that emerge at that time. You have one that is more left-wing, which is associated in the English-speaking world, not only with the Marxists, but also the anarchists. And you've got also a free market tradition that emerges at the same time. And what's interesting is that in the early 19th century, in the late 18th century, these ideas are becoming somewhat dominant. And when Malthus comes along, it's actually something of a pushback against this idea that humans can improve their lot. So the issue is a bit more complicated. There's private property, communism, and other issues. But throughout the 19th century, you've got people who are both what we would call today communists, anarchists, and free market types who sincerely believe that the way forward is to master nature.
Well, I was just going to ask, what do you think explains the emergence of that in the 19th century? Obviously, technological progress really took off then.
Yeah.
Did that create sort of a sense of optimism, or what was going on?
That's exactly what it is. And, you know, there's always a pushback. You know, the aristocracy in the 18th and 19th century is really where I think you find the first embryonic form of what we would call today modern environmental thought. You know, people who like the social order the way it is, who don't want to disturb it, and you've got to respect nature. There's a natural order of things, and you should not screw up with it too much. So if you look again at the English-speaking world among anarchists, let's say Goodwin is a fellow that we discuss a bit in the book, who again says that there's no limit to what we can create. And conservative people are like, oh, you think you're playing God or something? Bad things will happen if you disturb the natural order of things. So there's obviously a bit of a debate around those issues in the 19th century. But for the few scholars who have looked at this, they see really the turning point, at least in the English-speaking world, is the Great Exhibition of 1851 in London. So maybe the word the Crystal Palace will say something to some of your listeners, but long story short, there are people associated with, well, what we now call the Society of Arts. There's the The husband of Queen Victoria, Prince Albert, who decides, you know, he's a minor German noble, not so well viewed by the British elite, but he's a good guy from a perspective. Classical liberal believes in progress, lifting people out of poverty. They organize this big exhibition in London of the work of all nations. And so people from all over the world show, you know, their newest steam engine, embryonic electricity, all sorts of new things that are being created out of nature. And out of this comes, and the exhibition is very influential at the time, and out of this comes a sense of optimism that will really last, I would argue, until the First World War, when, let's say, European civilization falls apart and eventually there's a pushback against those ideas. But people just see how much change there is in the 19th century. We often believe that, you know, we're the smartest generation, that we've seen the most change, but most historians of technology agree that no, the people who saw the most change in human history are actually people who lived in the second half of the 19th century, because at the time, yeah, the steam engine has been around for a while, but suddenly you've got the railroad, which becomes massive, the telegraph, the steamship, electricity comes along. People begin to understand how to create substitute to nature, be it dyes or other things. And suddenly, people are able to globalize. It's the first era of globalization, if you will. Food becomes much more abundant, much cheaper. The population skyrockets the world over because infant mortality goes down, even though people don't quite understand antibiotics yet. But things are changing so fast, and everybody is so much better off that it's hard to argue against the fact that, no, there's no limit to what we can create. And I think this sense of pessimism, again, especially in the European context, really only begins to reassert itself with the two world wars. And you've got a pushback among certain groups. I don't like to bring Hitler too early in the conversation, but a lot of, there is this debate in the academic literature, how green were the Nazis? Well, of course, the Nazis borrowed all sorts of other ideas from elsewhere, but some of them had a strong Malthusian component in them. So again, maybe before I go into the reductio ad Hitlerium, we should perhaps clarify a few things before.
But you're touching on something that's interesting. So something that I've tried to bring up and what you're touching on there is environmental ideas today are sort of a conservative, small c conservative set of ideas, right? You touched on it, the sort of static look at things, wanting to conserve, wanting to stop, place constraints on what people can do. It's an interesting dynamic given the fact that today we think of conservatives as not, in the political context, we don't think of environmental issues as being necessarily conservative, right?
No, but you do have, well, that's because you're an American. Let me because, you know, that's the thing with conservatives in the United States tend to be what a lot of us would call classical liberals, at least in terms of outlook. But if you take a European perspective on things, there was always a strong divide between, let's say, I was talking about the Nazis, let's call them the blood and soil type conservatives versus the classical liberal ones. And if you look at the history of European conservative thought, as opposed to, let's say, American conservative thought, you see that this, again, a lot of this blood and soil stuff really historically came from the right. And one of the things that before COVID, I haven't really debated those issues in academic meetings since then, but I like to point out to my progressive, and I don't know why they still call themselves that, colleagues that, you know, oh, this great idea of food sovereignty, look, the Nazis were promoting autarky, or else the circular economies, the Nazis wanted zero waste. But ultimately, what they wanted to do was to preserve nature, and the Nazis were very good at curbing industry in order to save, you know, the essence of the Aryan race or what have you. So there is this whole movement that from a European perspective clearly came from what we would call the blood and soil / conservative type, as opposed to what in America you would call a classical liberal / conservative. And so there is this great irony, as you say, that a lot of progressives today in the American context have become extremely reactionary. And they believe that poverty is somehow more sustainable, Whereas if you go back a century and a half ago, and we do allude to that in the book, what are progressive complaining about? That poor people are extremely wasteful. They're so bad at producing food that, you know, if you go to Africa, the only thing that the young men can do is try to have more cows to impress the girl. That's why you need colonial authorities to rein them in. And so, but the problem of poor people ultimately is that because they're so inefficient in the way they produce food, they're eroding the planet away. And so you actually need more modern technologies to help heal nature, which again is, to put that in an American perspective, some sort of an old-fashioned left-wing New Dealer type of perspective. You need to build dams to control nature. You need electricity and more fossil fuel so that people stop chopping down trees, so that you address erosion problems. And all of this was lost. I'm not so explicit about the book because I still want to do more research to prove that. But I think ultimately what happened was that the Berlin Wall fell, and suddenly people from the left who were progressive who always argued that, oh, the market is leading us to our ruin, you know, profit motive, short-term thinking, bad, you need to put the smart people like us in charge. When the Berlin Wall fell, then suddenly they had to indict markets with some other perspective, and that's when a lot of them sort of went back to this old-fashioned Malthusianism, which they had criticized in the past. But that might be a bit... Well,
it's interesting. So in our political context in the United States right now on the left, there is sort of fights playing out between people who recognize, well, everything that we want to do in the name of addressing climate change requires to build new things and, you know, build out renewable energy, build out electric vehicles, all these things. But then they're flanked by a whole crowd that is says no to all of that as well. So it's just it's interesting how similar fights on similar political factions play out over time. I want to bring the focus back to our perspective, though, because that's what your guys' book is on. So the main argument of the book is that technological innovation, human ingenuity are often overlooked when we're talking about populations linked to climate change. What were some of the main misconceptions that you found about the relationship between population growth and environmental concerns? And then one other thing I want to discuss. So one of the things that we try to stress at IER is obviously the importance of institutions in shaping incentives and driving things like economic and environmental progress. And one of the things that you guys highlight in the book is sort of that institutional perspective. So just a broad overview of both what the main argument is, and then how the core, in my view, what I see as the core of sort of the classical liberal outlook is the institutional factors that play a role in solving these problems.
Okay. Well, first I'll be back, and I'll just backtrack for a little second.
Sure.
We do mention it in the book, but then after the book was published, I had a short column on that. And I find it remarkable that all the heads of the IPCCs are on the record somewhere as being strong Malthusians. So you can have you can find quotes even from the first Swedish fellow who was in charge, to then the fellow from India and the British fellow. They're all on the record saying, as there are too many people on Earth and this is not sustainable. So all the heads of the IPCCs, except the present one, I've looked, I couldn't find anything about him. They're all on the record as saying, as there are too many people on Earth and that this is not sustainable. And their outlook, again, I would argue, is that like many environmentalists or environmental scientists, they're unwilling to admit that humans have evolved beyond other animal species. That, again, we do things that other animals don't do. Now, it's one thing to say that people like us will promote technology. Again, the Marxists did that. But what sets us apart is that, again, as you see, the institution that we believe will achieve the best results. And what is missing often is... again, the kind of institutions that are unique to human beings. So think trade, for example. We're the only species that trade physical goods. The only other things you can see in nature are animals that will trade, let's say, grooming for protection. So animals will trade services, but they will not, through the price mechanism, ultimately, and intermediaries, trade goods. So what Simon, but also many other people pointed out before him, is that we've got this powerful feedback system built in human societies when people are free, which is the price system. And so what prices allow us to determine is what needs to be done at a certain point in time. So if you believe that you're going to run out of oil because the price of oil goes up for a while, or you're going to run out of copper or phosphorus rocks or whatever, well, the price goes up and prices send a signal in the rest of the economy, the rest of society, that we need to look for more of a particular resource. We need to use it more efficiently. And we need to find substitutes. And so without having the smartest people in charge, what we see in market economies in the last two centuries and a half is that more people actually means more wealth and more resource abundance. Because through the feedback mechanism of the price system, smart people who are free to do what they will do and are often motivated by what you would what some people on the left might consider filthy lucre, or what I read too much old stuff, or just, you know, greed. People will actually end up doing what needs to be done because they're guided by the price system, and people adapt their behavior or target their research effort at what really needs to be done. And so paradoxically, the more of us there are, as long as we're part of a market economy, things did not go so well in communist economies, which is something that our site does not discuss more or does not discuss enough. But in a free market economy where people reap the rewards of their behavior, typically through owning private property and by following, if you will, or answering the calls of the price system, the more of us there are, the more resources there are, the longer we live, the healthier we are. And we also see all sorts of good things happen to the environment in the process. I'm a geographer. The one example I like to use because it's so visually compelling is the reforestation of much of the earth in the recent decades. And what has happened, and what a lot of people among environmentalists are unwilling to admit, is that one of the great unsung things that humanity has done in the last two centuries is to replace resources that were grown or harvested on the surface of the planet, everything from wood to whale oil. We've replaced that by stuff that we've dug from below the surface of the planet. So coal, natural gas, petroleum, that not only gave us energy, but also all those synthetic products that are viewed as bad today. But plastic saved a lot of trees and other materials, you know, wool, cotton, all sorts of things that we didn't need. So there can be more of us, and there can be more trees, and we can be wealthier because, again, we've operated this whole substitution guided by the price system. But again, this is something that a lot of people, let's say on the other side of the debate, don't see or don't want to admit or just take for granted, which, again, is something that our side has not been good enough at explaining, I think, or pointing out. I mean, I say that obviously because that's what I'm trying to do at the moment, but yeah, well, sorry.
A huge part of that story, and maybe we should do a whole episode on it with you, yeah, is the process of finding, taking waste and turning it, yeah, into usable resources. And you've done a ton of work on that, looking at,
yeah, I'm kind of the black sheep
industries of that have done that. Yes. Yeah. Well, no, it's fantastic. And honestly, it's one of the main things that changed the way that I think about these sort of issues, is that when you discover that, oh, there's a waste or a byproduct from something, when, you know, the institutional structure is correct so that you can't just sort of unload them wherever and pollute, then people look to find new uses for these things. And the history of turning waste into usable things is really kind of the story of how so much industrial progress has taken place over the years, right?
Yeah, this is why, there are two things I believe that environmentalists don't understand. How can there be more of us and a cleaner nature? Well, the first, as I was telling you, was substituting those resources. And these ideas go back at least to the 19th century. And the first fellow who was very explicit about that was a German economist named Werner Sombart, who, again, reductio ad hilarium, sort of took a wrong turn in the 1930s. But, I mean, he had the basic ideas. But then what people also understood at the time is that the best way to fight industrial pollution is to find ways to create wealth out of waste. The problem that we have today is that when people think of recycling, they think of household waste. And, you know, what we throw out are things that are really heterogeneous and don't have much value. So let's say plastic packaging, food waste and what have you. So there, historically, there was it was difficult to kind of create value out of that. The beauty, if you will, of industrial waste is that it comes in large quantities and it is chemically, in terms of its composition, it's uniform. And so historically, there was always a way to see, okay, what do we have in there? Is there something we can extract, or is there something we can add that we could turn into a substitute for something else? And so, for example, plastics that are all around us were part of a long list of waste from petroleum refining that were eventually turned into something. So I don't know how much I should go into details, but just to stick to the example of petroleum refining, and if you want to do another episode, I could cover any number of industries. But at first, people, the incentive to extract petroleum in Western Pennsylvania in the United States was to find a substitute to whale oil that was becoming more expensive at the time. And so people realized that you could extract kerosene from petroleum, but then you were left with lighter fractions and heavier fraction. There was this thing called gasoline that people didn't know what to do with at the time, because if your listeners know anything about Molotov cocktails, the reason why they're such a potent weapon is because gasoline is very volatile. So Molotov cocktails would tell you that trying to burn gasoline in a lamp was never a good idea. But eventually, of course, internal combustion engine is developed. As engines become more sophisticated, you need a better quality of refined products. Then you end up with an even lighter fraction that you can eventually convert into plastics. And so you create more wealth and you reduce pollution at the same time, which is, again, something that a lot of environmentalists don't get, because they believe that if there is more of us, if we consume more, then obviously more stuff will be released into the environment. Whereas the industry, the history of industrial development tells you the exact opposite. The more of us there are, the more brains there are, the more incentive you have to turn pollution into something useful. And the more you keep every material that we handle into the circle of production, as opposed to releasing more of them in the environment. And unfortunately, the way, and I blame partly the modern economists, the last few generations for that, they think of economics so abstractly that they don't understand that these qualitative changes happened all along. And so we release very little in the environment today. And yes, there are a few scary statistics out there, but that's because they count things like, let's say, concrete. So they say, well, we've failed to recycle many things. And what has happened, for example, is the Chinese construction boom. And you say, well, once you build a highway, you don't recycle it. Okay, fine, but is that really an environmental problem? So, and that's how you get those statistics saying that humans recycle very little. It's because they count, you know, rock, sand, pebble, concrete, and stuff like that, and they go by weight. So anyway, but if you want to do an episode of that, I'll tell you how they sort of twist the statistics.
Yeah, maybe somewhere down the line, I think that'd be great. Yeah. Shifting back to the book, so in our intro, you sort of mentioned the circular economy, degrowth. There's all these terms out there that, in my opinion, sometimes it feels like they're talking about the same thing. Obviously, yeah, they have very specific definitions. I sometimes feel like they have all these complicated terms as sort of barriers to entry, right, to get into the conversation, right?
So yeah, the everyday jargon person doesn't. Yeah. Academic jargon is a powerful way to keep outsiders with common sense out of our discussions. Yeah, and if I can claim again, if I want to sell my book, if I want to encourage your listeners to look at my book, I think there are two things really that we contribute that you won't see, and let's call them the optimistic literature or the Julian Simon-esque literature. First, the history of thought. So we show that there were actually many debates between Malthus in 1800 and Paul Ehrlich in 1968, and that those same basic arguments about humans being different, innovating, took place basically every decade, or at least every generation, between Malthus and Ehrlich, and every time the optimist won. And again, the optimists in those days were not only free market types, but they were also people on the left, institutionalist, Marxist, anarchist. And then the other thing that we sort of contribute, and that's, I think I have a bit of a comparative advantage in there, is that I'm actually employed in an environmental studies department. Well, it's geography and environmental studies. So I've been bombarded and living among those people and those ideas for over two decades at this point. And so, yeah, if you want to know about the ecological footprint, degrowth, I mean, I try to keep things to the jargon to a minimum. But I try to address ideas that are constantly recycled using new jargon, as you say yourself. So the circular economy now used to be called industrial ecology 20 years ago. Degrowth is but a more radical version of what was called voluntary simplicity before and other things. So at least I try, without using too much jargon, I try to address the basic ideas that these people have been promoting, which ultimately boils down to only greater poverty is sustainable. And again, this is, I believe, this comes directly from a perspective in which we're no different than other animals. And the more of us there are, the worse things will have to be. But again, we're different. We've evolved beyond that.
So one thing I want to ask you, so since you work in a geography department, you're exposed to all this, nobody probably has a better sense of the critics than you do. Who would you say are the best critics of our perspective? Are they making slightly different lines of argumentation? Having worked in this policy circle for a decade, it's tough to find people who are willing to sincerely engage with our perspective a lot of the time. Yeah.
No, and God knows I've tried to poke the bear a few times and I've attacked a few people and haven't. No, the problem that you have with those people is that, you know, they might listen to you a little bit, but it's always the same answer. Well, this time is different. And, you know, what do you argue with that? You know, yeah. You try to explain the logic. You try to see again, no, division of labor, more people, resources from underground, spontaneous recovery of industrial waste. Oh, yeah. But this time it's different. And the climate emergency is something that we've never faced before. And, you know, you always have a few regrets once you write a book and you think, well, maybe I should have talked about something else. And I was researching at one point the development of Paul Ehrlich intellectually, and I came across this old book from the 1968, before he published A Population Bomb, in which you have this meeting of environmental scientists and they discuss all the problems that humanity is facing. So 68, we're going to run out of oil. We're going to run out of food. Water pollution is out of control. Air pollution is out of control. Global cooling is terrible. Global warming, CO2 emissions might be a problem. And what's interesting with Ehrlich is that he believes that everything is going to be a catastrophe. And he believes in that book in both global cooling and global warming at the same time, which is quite a feat, you know, 1968. And what's interesting is that, of course, all of these problems have been solved since then. There's more of us, there's more wealth, but at the same time, again, there are more trees in most advanced economies and increasingly in, let's call them medium range GDP per capita type of economy. Our water is cleaner, our air is cleaner. We have more carbon fuels than we know what to do if we let people extract them, you know, the shale revolution and all of that. And so what's left from that list? So global cooling went out of fashion. I mean, I'm old enough. I remember that's what we were taught in grade school in the 70s. I would read those comic books that would have, you know, oh, the new ice age is coming and terrible things will happen. So if you look at all that list, and what I wish I had done is that I would have included the whole list in the book and say, okay, check. What's left? Climate change. CO2 emissions. Obviously, CO2 emissions must be terrible because they're a product of human activity. The idea that a little bit of warming might actually be better is obviously not something that they will entertain. But what I nevertheless, what Joanna tried to hint at in the book is that, in a way, climate change became the dominant issues because all those other problems were kind of solved. It's well, you're obviously younger. Yep. I don't know what's your demographic, but we celebrated recently the anniversary of a movie called Soylent Green. And, you know, some people, even if they haven't seen the movie, what's Soylent Green? It's people. Now, what's interesting about Soylent Green is that it was supposed to have occurred already. Like, it was the distant future by then was like 2020 or something. And at that point in time, global warming was destroying humanity. We were running out of food. But again, if you look at this sort of the overpopulation, which was really the dominant fear that drove everything else in the 60s and early 70s, again, was disproved in all market economies. And so, yeah, we're left with CO2 emissions, which obviously must be catastrophic. But again, ultimately, if you scratch all the heads of the IPCC and the people who sort of buy into that, you always scratch a climate alarmist, you always find a Malthusian. And so even if some people like us would look, and especially, you know, okay, I'm I'm an economic geographer by training. I don't pretend that my understanding of the climate system is beyond a second year undergraduate geography student who would have taken a climate course, because, you know, that's my background. But the advantage I claim, I know a lot of history at this point. I've researched a lot of history. And you always see, you know, going back to antiquity in agricultural societies, people always believe that they're offending the gods, or that they need to throw a virgin in a volcano. Humans are really wired to worry about the climate for obvious reasons. I mean, if you look at our history, 300,000 years and mostly the wilderness, then maybe 10,000 years of agricultural societies. Of course, we're going to be worried about the climate. But what I find interesting, beyond everything else, is that if you look at that checklist of worries from the late 60s, all that is left now is climate change. But at the same time, of course, now we try to revive fears of plastics, and which are not a problem in advanced economies. But at the same time, we just take plastic for granted, and we don't understand that without plastics, well, there would be a lot more sheep on the face of the earth, and a lot less trees, and a lot more cotton. And so, I'm sorry, I ramble on too much, but...
No, it's great. So, I mean, I guess the shift that I've seen in my lifetime, I grew up in the 90s and I guess early 2000s, and climate change was a topic, but the main focus was we're running out of oil.
Yep.
And since then, obviously, our oil reserves have expanded. The more we use of it, the more we discover. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been an interesting shift. There's still people who raise concerns about resource depletion, but that's kind of an ancillary argument now.
And, well, there was this blog, I don't know if you were familiar with the oil drum. I mean, this whole peak oil movement. Yeah. Well, there was, peak oil was a big thing again. It's one of those things that, you know, people have been worried about running out of oil even before the first wells were drilled in Western Pennsylvania. So if you know a little bit about the history of the United States, people were looking for salt, and sometimes they would come across petroleum, and that's or else you were mining coal in England, and this stuff would come up at the surface. Then people realized that, oh, there's kerosene in there. And even before the first wells were drilled in Pennsylvania, people were worried about that. And then, of course, you've got government employees, the United States Geological Service and others, who will tell you, oh, we'll never find oil in Texas, we'll never find oil in California, or what our generation has seen in the 1870s will be the end of it. And again, it's about the fact that humans are not just mouths to be fed, but you know, brains to think of new solutions, hands to work. And so we're really, as Rob Bradley and others who have kept the Julian Simon tradition alive have pointed out, you know, we're resource creators. And resource depletion will always reappear. But I'm old enough to remember when, you know, environmentalists were in favor of natural gas because they thought we were running out of it. You know, they were for natural gas as long as they thought we were running out of it. Yeah. It was a transition fuel. But as soon as it became abundant because of new technology, then suddenly it became something terrible. So, yeah, you can never win, I guess.
Yeah. One of the things Rob has stressed with me is just reading old books about energy policy and how some of the topics come up over and over again, how the arguments shift and stuff. And it's been really interesting. I always point to, I have a book called Our Energy Future that that worries about the us running out of oil and how everything's going to be wind and solar. It was published maybe mid-1970s, and just how wrong they've been about so many things. But we've covered a lot. I think, you know, our listeners should have a good sense of the main arguments in the book, the main topics that you guys cover. What is it that you hope to accomplish with it in terms of just the broader public discussion about population and climate change in general? There's tons of organizations and individuals that are out there pushing for policies to sort of constrict population growth. There's tons of money that funds those organizations, obviously. It's not a topic that's going away anytime soon. So.
Yeah, it's, of course, the book did not have much of an impact among, let's call them progressive. But one of my goals when I began writing the book, and what I intend to do in the coming years, is to remind progressives of what their predecessors used to believe. You know, the left used to care about poverty, about lifting people out of poverty, about creating greater material abundance. And what I want to show them is that, well, you know, this sort of Malthusian degrowth perspective that you've embraced is really a conservative slash reactionary one, which is something that deep down they should know. But I just want to remind them that, you know, what their predecessors used to believe, and that the idea that they've embraced, or ideas that were historically associated with people that they would consider, you know, white, male, cis, conservative, reactionary, racist. You know, why do we need colonialism? Well, because you cannot let poor people develop, because they will ruin everything. So that's... I don't think we did, well, I'll take the blame, this Joanna. That's more my thing. Joanna had other contributions. She's an engineer by training, and she's interested in how people change their minds more than I am. But what I was hoping to do, and which what I'll try to do again, is to remind progressive of why they're called progressives in the first place. At the same time, I would like our side to have a better sense of the history between Malthus and Paul Ehrlich, because I think one problem we have is that the people who are at the forefront of our movement will know the history from, let's say, the late 16 to the 60s to the present. They'll know about Julian Simon. They'll know about data, let's say, since the 1960s. But there's a whole history before that that validate our perspective that has been forgotten. Or, you know, environmental historians tend to come from a certain perspective. I don't know if Birkenstock are still fashionable, but it used to be a joke, you know, how would you identify the environmental historian in a big academic history meeting? Well, look for the Birkenstocks, you know, these things. So it tended to attract a certain type of people who would only cover a certain number of topics. So there's not only, let's say, a 50-year history that validates our perspective, but there's really like a 200-year history that validates our perspective. And for people who don't like to discuss statistics, or who feel more emotionally about a topic, I think there is some value in telling a broader historical, in bringing a broader historical perspective to these topics, rather than just throwing a few numbers. And the typical answer you get is that, yeah, that was true, but now it's different. It's a bigger catastrophe than ever. But people have been saying that for 200 years. So I want to believe, perhaps naively, that if you show them, well, you know, 1800, 1825, 1850, 1875, 1900, the 1930s, perhaps the most horrible decade of intellectually in the history of the Western world, the fascism, communism, central planning, all these things have been tried before. And, you know, free markets triumph, humanity triumph. If you let people be free, they will spontaneously find a good solution, because, as you pointed out, good institutions will spontaneously channel human creativity and work into towards what needs to be done. So, I mean, to be honest, there is a lot that our site has produced. I tried to summarize it, but at the same time, these are the kind of the two perhaps more original contributions that I wanted to make. And so, yeah, the book was a step to that. I still believe it's fairly unique if you look at our side of the debate. And I'm hoping in the coming years to sort of dig deeper. And again, I don't like to make this reductio ad Hitlerium arguments, but in this whole debate where the Nazis green, a lot perhaps could be conveyed to the other side to make them realize that the ideas that they're pushing were around and were promoted by people that they might not find very congenial.
Well, I'd definitely echo your sentiment that our side should be paying attention to these issues. And your book, Population Bombed, is an excellent resource for the history and the ideas that shape the way that we think about these things. A link to purchase the book is going to be available in the show notes. I'm also going to include several links to some of the op-eds that you and Joanna have produced since the book was published, where you cover several topics, not just stuff that's in the book. Please rate and review and subscribe to the podcast. It helps other people find our work. Pierre, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, anytime. If you want to talk about industrial waste recycling, I'm available too.
Yeah, we'll have to get it scheduled sometime in the future here.
Okay, thank you so much.